Good morning. In the roster of state holidays, should more of them be Hawaiian holidays? The Hawaii County Council takes up a discussion some hope will lead to the legislature. We'll talk with Jerry Bell of the Association of Hawaiian Civic Clubs. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Last night, the world got a look at Molokai in Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown. It could inspire others to duplicate some of his experience, but will Molokai welcome it? We'll talk with Molokai Dispatch editor Catherine Cluett.
I'm Chris Vandercook. The Honolulu Museum of Art's Spalding House opens its door to the public to take some of the mystery out of creating and collecting contemporary art. We'll talk with director Aaron Padilla. And Maui is going to be a summer destination for the stand-up comedy audience. Producer Paul Chamberlain will tell us about his chosen headliners for the Maui Comedy Festival Summer Series.
That's the conversation for a Monday, June 15th. Today's news is next. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Happy Monday, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Looking at an island that's not always on the tourist radar, yeah?
Well, it may be more so, especially after last night. Now, viewers have already gotten a look at one of Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown destinations, Molokai, and it's a different experience from the memories of most tourists, and that's the point. As anyone who has actually been to Molokai knows, as long as you're respectful and don't make assumptions, well, Molokai can be indeed the friendly isle. Getting there may need a little more planning if the Molokai ferry slices the number of its trips. And while making it on Molokai or to Molokai is one thing, having a future there for recent Molokai grads and their families is another big question. Catherine Cluett is the editor of the Molokai Dispatch, and she's on the phone with us now to talk about all of that. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. How are you?
Doing well, thanks, and glad to be talking to you this morning. So pleasure. The first thing, Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown aired last night. What did you think of it?
Well, you know, I think he overall did a really good job of highlighting what's important about Molokai, and he talked a lot about, you know, as you said, the distinctions in attitude and you know, talked about the welcoming attitude versus the reputation that Molokai has. And I think that was, you know, a discussion that happens a lot on Molokai. So from that perspective, I think he did a really good job. And, you know, obviously Molokai ended up being a highlight of the show. So it sounded like it was a high point of his trip.
As it was a highlight of the show, and it offered a very different glimpse of what a lot of people have believed about Hawaii, is that sufficient to start having people maybe consider Molokai as a destination, and would that be a good thing for Molokai these days?
Well, you know, I think it depends on who you ask, and I really don't think that, you know, despite Anthony Bourdain's international acclaim, I don't think that the airing of the show is going to be enough to bring flocks of tourists to Molokai. You know, I think a few years ago when, you know, St. Damien and St. Marianne were canonized, people were gearing up for an influx of tourists as well, and it just never quite happened the way people thought it might. I think Molokai has always been a destination for a very specific group of people, and I think that, as you mentioned, a lot of that has to do with coming with the right attitude, coming with humility, coming with an open mind, and really coming to learn rather than to assert your own ideas or to change Molokai, as Walter Nakei pointed out on the show. So, you know, I don't see that Anthony Bourdain's airing is going to bring a different crowd, but I think it's, you know, was a great way to raise awareness of some of those stereotypes and that Molokai may not actually fit them. So that's a good message.
So, Catherine, who is the crowd which comes to Molokai?
I think it's you know, as I mentioned, a specific kind of tourist that is looking for, you know, Molokai has been dubbed as the real Hawaii or the old Hawaii, and I think it's a very different type of experience. As he mentioned, each island has a very distinct, identity, and Molokai is a place where the culture is extremely rich. The environment, you know, is very well preserved, and So for that reason, people come with a different, you know, hopefully a different idea of what, you know, Hawaii is or what Hawaii used to be. And it's not a place where, you know, hula dancers just dance for tourists in Waikiki. You know, it's a place where hula is practiced on a daily basis, is a very important part of that cultural preservation. And so it's just kind of a different mindset, I think, on Molokai.
A little later this week, on Thursday and Friday, the County of Maui Office of Economic Development is going to be there on Molokai with you to, you know, talk about what Molokai needs and maybe how they can meet some of those needs. What's on your list?
It's an interesting discussion for sure. You know, Molokai is a place where, you know, we have the highest unemployment in the state. We have, a large number of residents on welfare. But I think it's a different mindset here as well. You know, just because you don't have a steady job doesn't mean that you're not able to provide food for your family. And so the look at economics is a different kind of discussion on Molokai. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes out of that discussion. And there's a lot of very intelligent, resourceful people on Molokai that have started some really awesome businesses. So I look forward to seeing those, seeing those grow. And what really comes out of this discussion of looking at, you know, positive ways and careful ways in which the economy can grow on Molokai. I think Molokai has a reputation of saying no to a lot of things, but I think it's really more about saying yes to the right things in the right kind of way. So it's a very real discussion on Molokai right now.
Catherine Kluwer, what are some of those businesses that obviously the community has said yes to and businesses that you hope will grow?
There's a lot of, a lot of locally owned shops. A lot of people are starting clothing lines and starting, fostering native arts as a business. And so, at the Made in Maui County Festival not too long ago, Molokai had a really large part in that, and people are excited about the products that are coming out of Molokai. A lot of agricultural products are coming to the forefront. You know, Molokai sweet potatoes. Molokai has the best honey in the state, according to the honey experts. And so there's a lot of really great products, a lot of really, you know, as I said, resourceful people who are capitalizing on Molokai as being a really special place and offering a different type of product that the world can enjoy.
Are those products really going out to the rest of the world as opposed to coming to other islands, to Honolulu, where you know, we all might be able to enjoy them too? Or are they really going out to the rest of the world?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think with the age of technology, people on Molokai certainly aren't left behind, and internet marketing has certainly been fostered here recently, especially, there's a lot of, next door to us, actually, at the Molokai Dispatch, the Kuha'o Business Center is helping local businesses take the next step in their business. And so, you know, some of that is internet marketing and really getting products out to a larger scale. So I think it's a combination of the two.
Some of that business travel, though, involves leaving, or some of the business actually involves travel and leaving Molokai. What are the discussions that have been ongoing since the announcement that maybe the ferry might have a very different schedule in future?
It's going to have an interesting impact. For youth graduating from Molokai, you mentioned, every year we sort of look at the graduates and say, where are these people going to be, these young adults contributing to the community? Are they going to take their talents elsewhere? Are they going to come back to Molokai? And every year there's a pretty significant portion of students who say, you know, hey, I want to go get my doctorate degree. I want to become a public servant of different types and bring those skills back to Molokai. So that's really good to see. A lot of times the reality of it is that, you know, they don't always end up on Molokai. But the ferry is going to have a significant impact, I would say, largely for students. There's a lot of cheaper ways to get to Maui. There's airfares that are much faster and less expensive and don't result in the seasickness that sometimes comes from taking the ferry. But the ferry is really a key form of transportation for students on Molokai to get to athletic events on Maui, for students to get to academic competitions and learning opportunities off-island. And so because of the schedule changes that are being proposed, you know, students may have to miss more school, for example, if they have an athletic event on Friday, instead of leaving at 4:30 in the morning on Friday morning, they may have to leave, you know, the previous day. And so it's going to have a large impact on those students that, you know, we see as the future of Molokai for sure.
And being driven by the ferry, because they say that they have many routes that they are going with very, very few passengers, if at all. So they're losing money with the cost of fuel and what they have to pay for their overhead, that it's really causing them to lose money too. Is there a bad feeling with the ferry, or do people actually understand that they might have a point?
I think there's a lot of understanding. I don't think that anyone can blame them for, you know, for the decreasing numbers. You know, back in 1986 when they began, they had, you know, around 60 passengers who worked on Maui and traveled the ferry back and forth daily. And now there's, you know, there's less than 10. So I think the numbers are a very clear indicator of, you know, the amount that the ferry is being used, unfortunately, and people still rely on it, but it's used in a different way and not as consistently, probably, as the ferry would need to continue operation economically. So I think there's a lot of understanding, but, you know, there's also petitions circulating supporting the ferry's proposal to operate as needed instead of, you know, that twice daily round trip, just as a way to at least continue some kind of ferry operation, because the value is certainly recognized.
It's kind of hard to plan when it's just sort of as needed according to whom.
Exactly. And I think there's a lot that remains to be seen with that. And, you know, hopefully when a group of students needs it, you know, I'm not sure of the numbers that they would need in order to qualify for that as needed operation, but hopefully it would still be available at least for the majority of the need.
Catherine Cluett, thank you very much for spending a little time with us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Beth Ann.
Catherine Cluett is the editor of the Molokai Dispatch. She's lived on Molokai for 7 years. The Dispatch is now preparing to celebrate its 30th anniversary.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:16, and coming up, an opportunity to look over the shoulders of Hawaii's contemporary artists. But first, your quiz.
O Maui, o Kaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
A little later in the show, we'll have a look at a special brand of comedy, and that got us thinking about one of the most creative local talents. He was born in 1950 and began his professional career in the 70s after graduating from Punahou. In 1974, he, James Grant Benton, and Ed Kahea created the comedy ensemble Booga Booga and set a high school standard for local satire. Some of his best work was done in TV specials, the first of which won an Emmy and a bronze medal in 1982 from the International Film and Television Festival of New York for Most Outstanding Television Production. Many folks of all ages still can quote favorite lines from routines like Room Service and Auntie Marielani's Cooking Show, and have fond memories of characters including the Independent Republicrat candidate Willie Monowilly and the secret taste test subject Mr. Okada. For today's Backyard Quiz, we're looking for the name of this comedy genius. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And if you're fast, you'll be the first caller and winner of the HPR t-shirt.
I'm Mark Berwick from the Honolulu Cricket Club, and you're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
What do artists do all day? We're familiar with their finished products, but most of us don't know all that much about their process. We'll see the art without getting to know the craft behind it, and whether it's painting, sculpture, ceramic art, photography, or any of the other means of expression that are out there to channel the creative impulse. Starting this weekend, the Honolulu Museum of Art Spalding House is opening its doors to the public for 9 days of hands-on demonstrations and workshops to take us beyond the veil. Spalding House Director Aaron Padilla is on hand to tell us more. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning.
Why is this, necessary? Why is this a good idea to sort of reveal how it's done to people?
Well, recently we kind of redid our mission, vision, and values for the museum.
Uh-huh.
And there's a line in there that it says, connecting great art with people. And I think this program at Spalding House coming up in the coming week is perfect for that statement. Contemporary Art Shop is actually a fundraiser for the museum, and we have over 400 works of art on view for the 10 days mm-hmm. of Contemporary Art Shop. And what we wanted to do was create programming that augmented that sale/exhibition. So when you walk into the galleries and you see this great painting on the wall, you'll know how that it was made, or the exquisite glass bowl, or mm-hmm. the ceramic sculpture. We're bringing an artist to do gallery talks, to talk about their work, as well as demos and workshops in the afternoons. So it'll be this kind of experience where you can see, make, touch everything.
You trained as a ceramic
yes.
artist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you went through that whole process, that whole kind of craft becoming art, apprentice becomes a real master, that whole progression from craft to art, developing of skills, right?
Yes, exactly. And, it's something when you first touch a material and you kind of fumble your way through trying to build something and construct something without it falling down. It's this kind of great achievement, right?
Yeah, sure.
And you do it over and over again, and sometimes you fail and sometimes you succeed. And the longer you do it, the more success you have and less failure. And there's something to be said about doing something over and over again for a long period of time. You can't fake that. You can't rush that. It's like a bonsai tree, right? It's a year old tree.
Mm-hmm.
You try to make it look old, but there's nothing. It cannot be 50 years old in a year, you know? So it's that skill, that informed hand that you ultimately gain by doing a process over and over again. And that's the kind of things that we want to show in the next week.
The whole thing of developing that painstaking development of a skill.
Yes.
Over years and years, and eventually reaching the point where you can keep something you've made. That's not the prevailing ethos out there today by any means, is it? I mean, now it's sort of like, how quickly can I get there?
Exactly. It's, I think we have the internet and Google and YouTube to kind of fault that. It's, we are instant experts today. You can go up and search anything online and know how to do it. But that doesn't really replace actually doing it over and over again. And I think the artists that we have coming up to the museum in the next week, we've selected them because they have put in the time and have the skill and have been fearless in honing that skill.
For the viewer of art, the person who comes to a museum,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's very easy to look at a representational painting, a Turner or something of a beautiful ocean scene,
mm-hmm.
and you don't need a lot of training to know that's beautiful. It looks like a sun going down over the ocean, and there's not a lot of, you don't have to train yourself to understand it. In contemporary art, a lot of sort of conceptual art, it's not as accessible as something, you know, as a pretty picture, as a beautiful bowl, as anything that immediately grabs you. How do people get to that, you know?
Well, you know, I think it's, I'm not, it's a little bit of, I think in the culture that and place that people are coming from kind of holds people back.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we go down the street, walk down Waikiki or the galleries there, what do you see? You see sunsets and beaches and whales. And I think...
stuff that's immediately accessible.
Immediately accessible. But that's here in Hawaii. Now, if we lived in New York or L.A. or Chicago and you walk down the same row of galleries, it would be something different. So I think the perception and what we know collectively is different. But I think, I really do believe that contemporary art, conceptual art, there is still that kind of, that visceral, guttural kind of connection that you can get with it, even though it doesn't depict a sunset or a beach or something tangible and recognizable. You know, it's still art. It's still material. It was still crafted.
And it's still, it needs to be given a chance.
Yes, exactly.
Sense, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, this is a really good opportunity for people, Aaron, and thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
Aaron Padilla is the director of the Honolulu Museum of Art Spalding House, whose Contempo Art Shop event begins Friday and runs for 9 days. It's free and open to the public, and you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Back in oil fields are home to a bunch of new oil boom towns, but fracking has come at a cost to workers.
As Jesse was helping to pick up some of these men, some of the men's skin came off in his hands.
A new investigation from Reveal finds that fatalities are on the rise in the fracking industry. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
The plan to put a small sand island roof over the heads of homeless people has its roots in the mainland tiny house movement. Unlike some of those communities, though, there are some distinct differences with the Hawaii proposal, and they're causing a stir with some local organizations. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, BFN.
First of all, let's talk about what's being offered here, what's being discussed. The idea of taking container homes and putting them on Sound Island. But those are very different from the tiny house communities that we've seen, particularly on the Pacific West Coast.
Right. So Mayor Caldwell earlier this month said we're going to not put tents up there in Sound Island, but actually 25 modified shipping containers. They would be temporary houses, maybe house 75 to 100 people. He calls this the compassionate part of his compassionate disruption to deal with homeless. The city is still going to enforce, you know, those sit lie laws and whatnot. But it's not quite the same as what's in Eugene, Oregon. And Louis Kanea took a look at what they did, spoke to people there, and it's pretty cool. There's some photos on our site of the structures, which are not shipping containers in Eugene, by the way. They are actually wooden structures, often built with the help of people involved.
I mean, they look like little tiny neighborhoods, and every house is different. I mean, they're little teeny tiny houses.
It's kind of charming looking, actually. But there's even more to it than that. The people that live there have to sign a consent form. No violence, no theft. No weapons, no drugs, no alcohol. They have to put in about 10 hours a week staffing the area, for example, the front desk there, helping to clean bathrooms. And this sort of thing has given people sort of a sense of pride, a sense of ownership over these communities. There are others in Portland, Oregon, Olympia, Washington, I think Fresno, California. Others planned as well for Austin, Texas, and Madison, Wisconsin. So it's very hopeful. And by the way, this isn't really necessarily for homelessness. It's for people who are trying to reduce their carbon footprint on the planet and just live cheaper and more simply.
Right. I mean, there are people who are choosing this, but in terms of the
Correct.
Way it's being characterized for Hawaii and the proposal that we're looking at, some of the key questions are, well, you know, who is going to be making the decisions about what happens, who's going to be running it, and how much input are the people who actually live in the community, if it happens, will they have? Because it sounds very different from what you just described with the communities there on the Pacific West Coast.
It is. And Louis Kanea actually took a look at the RFP for what's planned here. And one big difference is that a contractor will be in charge rather than self-governance. There will be security 24 hours, you know, around the clock. A two-month maximum residency, it appears to be the case. In other words, this is really temporary. And there's more. You can't bring kids in there. As we all know, there's a lot of homeless families on the streets of Honolulu. Nor will the facility be ADA compliant, that is, to help people with disabilities. So these are very big differences that give one pause. Groups like the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice says they're worried it's just going to be an emergency shelter and a whole lot of folks might not actually go there.
Yeah, when we talked to Jenny Lee from Appleseed last
right.
week, I mean, her whole point was, well, this just may mean that they're going to be back on the street again. And so kind of so what? A lot of money invested into this for what purpose?
Well, we'll see. We'll give the mayor a little time here to see if it works out. Certainly, it's, as he himself said, a more compassionate approach, trying to put people into housing. But in the meantime, we're going to keep kicking people off the street for sitting and lying.
All right. Well, right now we have to kick you off the air because we got to go.
Thanks, Bethann.
Thanks, Ted. Talk to you tomorrow.
Very compassionate of you.
Oh, well, always. Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, when somebody gets diagnosed with chronic pain and needs medication for it, that's a problem, isn't it?
Well, it can be. And today we're going to talk a little bit about what are some of the warnings that doctors should be giving patients who take medication for chronic pain. And we're going to be talking to somebody who's had this situation touch her personally. She lost her sister from an overdose. And we're going to discuss what are some of the things people should be hearing and how often they are hearing them about the current concerns with chronic pain medication use.
Almost all of which are addictive, right?
Pretty much they are. You know, the biggest concern we have is if we create a large population of people who become addicted to pain medication, how are we going to manage that? Because part of that addiction is requiring an accelerating dose, even more and more medicine to treat the same level of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some better options these days. And doctors need to help explain to people why these better options are, in fact, a better choice and help move people away from medicine that might not be doing what we think it should.
Because it's not uncommon for somebody with a back injury or any number of issues to be told, here's, you know, Vicodin and you need to keep taking it if you want to keep the pain at bay, right?
Well, and for short-term use, obviously, that's not the issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you need to take something for 2 or 3 weeks, that's fine. But if
right.
you start taking something for 2 or 3 months or 2 or 3 years, then that becomes a concern. So a lot of people who have acute pain or some injury that they developed, they often get worried that people are going to assume they want pain medicine because they just need it for a short period of time. So we also have to talk about some of the discrimination that seems to go on as soon as somebody comes in and says, I need a pain pill.
Sure.
Not everybody is an addict.
Sure. Well, that's a lot of people are going to be interested in that, Kathy. So thanks very much. We'll look forward to that.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, and that's tonight at 5.
Good morning. I'm Jan Fried. I'm a professor and coordinator at the University of Hawaii Kapi'olani Community College. You're listening to The Conversation at Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
since your school days, you've probably liked holidays. Holidays have changed over the years, though, with some bundled together for convenience sake or to give some value added to a holiday. In Hawaii, two of the 13 on the state calendar celebrate Hawaiian history. We just had Kamehameha Day last week, you'll remember. And in future, there could be more state holidays commemorating Hawaiian history. Tomorrow, the Hawaii County Council will consider a non-binding resolution to add Restoration Day. The Association of Hawaiian Civic Clubs would like that. The group wants holidays traditionally celebrated in the kingdom to be official holidays with days off to celebrate. Earlier this morning, I talked with Jerry Bell, president of the Hawaii Council of the Association of Hawaiian Civic Clubs, and she favors a holiday cafeteria plan.
There is an option, you know, maybe an opportunity to allow individuals, let's say the state and county governments, to choose their holidays based on their own beliefs and practices.
So a situation where, say...
Well, let's say Christmas, and it's not a Jewish holiday. And that may be something that La Hoi Hoi Ea could be substituted for. Or July 4th, what else? Admissions Day. Yeah, those holidays.
So in other words, people would be able to pick their holidays based on their own preferences.
Their own preferences, right.
Not necessarily something that would be consistent with what everybody is doing. Now, part of that, though, has been the convenience factor. If you know that there are certain holidays as a business, you can plan for those. If you have people kind of coming and going, that sometimes can be difficult. But we've seen some changes in recent years in flex time anyway. Do you just see this as an extension of that?
Yes, exactly. And I worked for the National Park Service. And I saw that happen over the years where when I started in the government, it was a strictly Monday through Friday, 7:30 to 4 work schedule. And when I retired, there was maxi and flex time, which made it convenient for employees as long as they put in their 40 hours of work.
So this is just one more way of being able to accommodate a very changing workforce.
Exactly.
So what happens from this point on as you're looking at what holidays to import or what might be in the offering of holidays? What do you think should be added?
Well, La Hoi Hoi Ea, we took that to the, to Danny Paleka, one of our local council members. And it was introduced at the Committee on Government Relations and Economic Development. Then on Tuesday, it'll come before the full council. So we'll see how that goes. There were questions as to whether or not the County of Hawaii had the legal authority to establish holidays, and I guess it was determined that they did not. But that required further research by the Corporation Council.
No, but that doesn't really necessarily stop them from being able to say in a resolution, we want to consider it. And what I'm hearing you say is that you want to see some more conversation around this.
Right, right. Some of us in the room when we testified felt that the resolution didn't go far enough, and I think some of the council members felt that way. So we'll see what happens tomorrow.
If everything were to be successful at this run, what else would you like to see added into the list of holidays that someone might be able to take?
There were two others that were mentioned in conversation but are not in the county's resolution. And that is the birth date of our queen, Liliuokalani, and Kalakuokoa. And that was the Kingdom of Hawaii's Independence Day, which was celebrated on November 28th.
So you're talking about maybe two or three holidays in addition to the 13 or sometimes 14 when we have Elections Day that the state already has. How problematic do you think that would be for the state to let people mix and match which holidays they want to have? Not just as a business, but as the state doing that.
I don't know the extent of that and how much of a problem it would be. But that's an option that we're looking at to minimize the number of holidays that the state would recognize.
For the purpose of just sort of figuring it out and doing a cost of all of this.
Right, exactly. boils down to the cost-effectiveness of adding additional holidays to the state calendar.
And having days when certain people who might be key to a project may not be there, and other people who might need them, which is kind of the whole idea behind why they were standardized, even with a lot of American holidays where they've been collapsed. Once upon a time, there was Washington's birthday and Lincoln's birthday, and they all got smushed together in President's Day
President's
for
Day.
Convenience.
Yeah.
So how
and
much?
And, you know, there, that could be an option, too. Let's say Admissions Day. You know, it could be a dual holiday. Of course, the dates would be different. But somebody would have to figure out those options.
The idea behind it is to stop and take a moment and recognize why you're taking that pause in your routine. If those holidays were to be sort of smushed together, would that fulfill the purpose if you had several different Hawaiian holidays celebrated on a particular day?
Well, it may. It depends on the outcome. We've taken the resolution, Councilman Paleka has taken the resolution to the County of Hawaii. And, of course, the resolution asks that the Hawaii State Legislature designate July 31st as La Hoi Hoi E Ia. So we'll see what happens to that resolution if it's passed by the County Council and how much further it gets.
Well, we don't have long to wait for that because it's just tomorrow.
Right.
Jerry, thanks so much for taking some time this morning.
Oh, you're welcome.
Aloha.
Aloha.
Jerry Bell is president of the Hawaii Council of the Association of Hawaiian Civic Clubs. She is a retired National Park Service superintendent. And again, tomorrow, the Hawaii County Council will be considering that non-binding resolution to add Restoration Day.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we remembered a Hawaii comedian of the 70s and early 80s whose topical humor still rings true today. His work with partners James Grant Benton and Ed Kaahea won him a large local following, and recordings like 1978's Poi Dog and 79's Do I Dare Disturb the Universe helped make him a star. For many who grew up in the islands, lines like Not Too Sweet, Not Too Rancid, and No Be Silly, Vote for Willie still bring to mind his classic TV shows and comedy albums. His famous room service routine played on the frustration of a hungry tourist trying to order from a preoccupied room service operator. His puka shell tour guide poked fun at the local visitor industry. And whether it's Auntie Nellie Kulolo's matchmaking service, Data Tita, the Mahalo Airlines flight attendant who said, "For your safety, a package of party balloons is provided directly under your seat," our Mr. Okada from the Secret Taste Test, they're all part of the late Rap Replinger's rich cast of characters.
And we had a caller who knew that. Candy Everett called in from downtown Honolulu. So, Candy, you get the HPR T-shirt. It's now 8:44. That's the answer to today's Backyard Quiz. And if you've got one for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Kent from the Japanese American Citizens League. You're tuned in to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
It's time for Stargazer, our weekly look at what's happening in the universe and our island skies. As usual, we turn to Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee, Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on?
Hey, Dave. Good to be here. Venus and Jupiter will be low in our horizon to the west, with Venus setting around about 10 p.m. and Jupiter following it around about 10:30 p.m. Saturn will still be visible throughout the night until it sets at around about 4 a.m. Now, our moon will be a mere thin crescent in our early evening sky and will set just after sunset. Now, this is great news for stargazers, as it means we will be treated to wonderful dark skies and perhaps even a view of the center of the galaxy.
Now, there's this thing that we have talked about a few times, I'm thinking, on Stargazer, and I understand that you have a little bit more about it, and that is the mysterious bright spots that have been noticed on Sirius.
Yeah, that's right. We are revisiting the Dawn spacecraft on its historic mission to explore that mysterious dwarf planet in the asteroid belt, Ceres.
Since we've been talking about these mysterious spots, what have we learned about them?
Well, these white spots have been creating quite a buzz recently, mostly because there is no other feature on the surface of Ceres that looks quite like them. They're situated inside an impact crater. They are bright. Now, this indicates they must be made of something reflective. We have a substance that reflects a lot of sunlight here on our own planet. Of course, we know it as ice.
So if that's the case then, Christopher, how come we haven't seen a similar sort of phenomenon either there on Ceres or in other explorations that we've done?
Well, that's an excellent question. And let's look at the evidence. So far, we have an impact crater, a big one. In fact, the crater is 55 miles across. That means it's also going to be deep. Perhaps a large comet or asteroid smashed into the surface of Ceres with such force that it cracked the crust. What happened next is possibly the really interesting part. Imagine there was an ocean under the surface. Imagine that impact was so strong that water from the ocean gushed up onto the surface and froze solid.
So there is no way, Christopher, from as close as we've gotten to take a look at this thing so far, that it could be any sort of development of any kind, meaning that it was an actual structure or something.
If it is, Dave, I'll eat my furry mountain hat.
Is that fairy mountain or furry mountain?
That's furry.
Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee. Thank you for the report.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
A comedian walks out onto a bare stage with nothing but a microphone to hide behind. And that doesn't offer a whole lot of protection. You have to be able to engage the audience right away. And if you can get it on your side, the evening just flows and the laughs come easily. Experienced comedy performers know how to hit that sweet spot night after night. These are the artists producer Paul Chamberlain has picked for the Maui Comedy Festival's summer series, which starts this weekend. He's on the line to tell us more. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Chris.
I'm always struck by how much courage it takes to be a comedian, aren't you?
I am. I have such reverence for it, and I'm, of course, biased, but I think it's the purest art form out there.
Well, you certainly don't need a lot of props, do you?
No, you don't. You are going out there with your own point of view, a sense of humor, and there's no band backing you up. There's no dancers to distract. There's not even any kind of stagecraft. It's just you.
Even if you have, someone else with whom to interact, that can be a source of comfort, or certainly a band or even a musical instrument to hide behind. It's pretty naked, isn't it?
It is. And to hear these artists talk about their early career, talk about bombing, talk about weird audiences, drunk audiences, and then talking about their best audiences, that when everything clicks, you can really feel. I mean, it is a visceral experience for them.
But yet most performing artists will tell you that they honed their craft in part through a series of fairly terrible experiences, yeah?
That's it. And, I mean, that starts to become legend. I mean, as a matter of fact, there's some comedians that broke into the mainstream by having epically bad sets and responding accordingly. Bill Burr was somebody that he became a YouTube sensation at a very bad set, and he broke from script, and it was an inspired moment. Yeah, it's kind of famous in the industry.
So he broke from script because the script wasn't helping him anyway, right?
Exactly. There's a lot of YouTube videos up there of comics just eviscerating hecklers and things like that. So it's just like going to a NASCAR race and seeing a crash. It's like sometimes that's where people go and hope to see something that is a little bit out of the ordinary. And in the hands of these truly skilled artists, their crowd work is amazing to watch.
It would probably have to be, because in my limited experience in comedy clubs, there seem to be people out there who want you to be terrible so they can get with the heckling and they can be the show, yeah?
Yeah, and that has become, with the advent of social media, with the advent of people, you know, inappropriately using their phones, recording things, the tolerance level has dropped considerably. I mean, if in all the comedy clubs in New York and L.A., it's like no recording, no cell phones, no heckling, no exceptions. And it's liberating to see that, because it's the equivalent of walking into a movie theater or going to a live musical performance. It's like you don't talk to the stage, you don't make noise, you don't get up, you don't, you know, clinkle silverware.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see the art form of stand-up comedy begin to ascend to a level of that kind of audience respect.
Yeah, because that is refreshing, because, you know, one of the things, I play music, and at least people don't actively want you to be terrible. They'll tell you if you are, but, you know, there's a feeling in most of the performing arts of an audience that wants you to do well.
Exactly. And comedy, you know, for some reason, I think there's a great deal more people that think they're funny than think that they're musically inclined. So, and, you know, at their peril, you know, they will engage a comic. And a lot of the comics today are very skilled in crowd work, very skilled in dealing with hecklers. So, yeah, it's not a pretty sight when somebody has a couple of drinks in them and tries to go toe-to-toe.
Well, there's a long path between being somebody who's the class clown and thinks he's pretty funny to being a seasoned comedy performer, and a lot drop off the boat, don't they?
Most definitely. I mean, some of these, I mean, especially the comedians that we have coming for the summer series, I mean, these are gentlemen who have worked on their material for years, and some of them work on years to get a good 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's really, and then when you start to see them do, you can't help but see them do the same material in different venues, especially live, and to see how that's tweaked and modified and blended in is really something to see. That was probably the most fascinating thing for me, was when we brought over the comedians last year for the comedy festival, and to see them affected by Maui, as everyone is when they come to Hawaii. We had a blessing for them. We took them out snorkeling and things like that. And within like 48 hours, they were integrating their experiences on Hawaii into their material beautifully and seamlessly. And it was hilarious. And these were people that had never set foot on the Hawaiian Islands before.
Well, because no matter how well-honed your act is, it doesn't occur in isolation. There's a feedback loop with the audience in good comedy, right?
Most definitely. And that was the funny thing, because these were comics that, you know, their stock and trade were, you know, cynicism and pessimism and looking at, you know, things side-eyed. And they're on Maui for 2 days, and they're like, I don't know how I'm going to be bitter up on stage. I'm going to give it my best shot. and it all worked out famously.
Yeah, I spent an evening in a New York comedy club a couple of years ago, and everybody was ironic and bitter and self-deprecating and neurotic and, you know, all those New York things, right? They wouldn't necessarily play here, would it?
No, and then they held up a mirror to that, and it was even more funny because of that. They began to self-deprecate in their, you know, their positioning of the world juxtaposed to Maui, and they're like, yeah, it's ridiculous how we are, and this is beautiful, and you people are so lucky.
Well, in a way, what you're seeing is you're kind of seeing almost a witness to a growth in them as a performer right there on the spot.
Yeah, when we had the blessing, it was a galvanizing experience. I mean, these were people that travel the road all the time, that deal with big audiences in L.A. and New York, and then do small comedy clubs in the flyover states. And so when they came here, they were getting up at 9 o'clock in the morning. These are guys that perform at night and get up maybe at 11 or 12. They're getting up at 9 o'clock in the morning to go hiking, to go bodyboarding, you know, to go exploring, and they were just drinking it in. And it it was a very unique festival and even live comedy experience that I've ever seen.
So Maui got a chance for them to lose that barroom pallor, huh?
Yes, most definitely. Most definitely, yeah.
Well, that's to the good.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Paul. Good to talk to you. Good luck with the festival, yeah?
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Paul Chamberlain is the originator and executive producer of the Maui Comedy Festival Summer Series, series of performances throughout the summer that begins this Saturday with comedian Todd Barry performing in Paia at Charlie's Restaurant and Saloon.
Blind Willie Johnson and Big Bill Brunzi, Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. Hear the stories behind these names and the music that became known as the Delta and Chicago Blues. Rick Smith and the Trailer Park Romeos school you in all things blues in the Atherton Studio, Saturday, June 27th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets at hprtickets.org or call 955-8821 during business hours.
We don't always hear much about the island of Molokai, and we don't always hear enough from the island of Molokai. So it was good to hear from Catherine Kluwit today.
And if you missed the CNN Parts Unknown, Anthony Bourdain's show, you can probably find that on demand. But last night I watched it after we came back from the Hawaiian Home Companion, which was also a great show. If you missed that, sorry about that one. But it was really interesting to see how respectfully they approached Molokai and how frank some of those discussions were.
Well, I'm assuming that they got shown around by people who emphasized the need to be respectful and courteous on Molokai, because there's a real value system that prevails there that's it's pretty healthy. It's refreshing to see.
That happened, and they actually recorded back in February, and so there was a lot of prep work that was done apparently beforehand to make sure those inroads were being done appropriately and with respect. And I think it showed last night in the final product.
Well, good, because we need to keep that place in mind more.
And there's a lot more going on Molokai, as we're going to find out later on when there's more meetings this afternoon, or rather on Thursday and Friday, about the economic future of Molokai. So we'll talk about that in future, too. But for now, we got to say goodbye. Tomorrow, we're going to talk more about the Red Hill Fuel Tank Agreement. We're going to be speaking with Ernest Lau from the Board of Water Supply.
And we're looking ahead to a day-long immersion in the art of Hawaii's best photographer.
Call our talkback line anytime you'd like to leave us a comment. That number is 808-792-8217. Or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook as Hawaii Conversation. And you can tweet us at Hawaii Conversation, H-I Conversation, or at B-K-O-Z-H-P-R.
And you can find past shows under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning right here for more of The Conversation. See you then.